Welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 12th of October 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of the week, and we are assembled here to discuss the latest news and look at a greatest Britain, and who better to have this discussion with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, hello sir, how you doing?
I'm doing very well indeed. I've had a very good weekend, and I'm looking forward to the week ahead. I'm looking forward really also to the gradual resolving as we go through this autumn of this this COVID-19 debacle. I think one way or another it's going to come to a head and will be resolved, and so the country will be for the new year, I hope, relieved of the torpor that holds it in its grip at the moment.
Well, more and more people are resisting against it. There were lots of medical professionals and scientists have written to the government saying that this has got to stop. A lot of the people in the north are saying we can't be dealing with this again. And we were going to go into another story, but I might as well just mention this now. The government's deputy chief medical officer has claimed the UK is nearly back to where it was in March, as hospital admissions for coronavirus surged by 50% in a week in England. Jonathan Van Tam told MPs that intensive care units in the northwest could be full within 3 weeks, as the latest figures show there are now 3,090 COVID-19 patients being treated in English hospitals. This is just 7 fewer than on March the 23rd, when the national lockdown was imposed. On Wednesday, 491 new patients were admitted to hospitals, close to the 586 on March 19th, the week before Boris Johnson gave his stay-at-home order. So what does this tell us? This tells us that the lockdown has achieved absolutely nothing. We are now back in exactly the same position that we were in March, only we've totally destroyed the economy on the way. We've ensured that lots of elderly people have died without seeing their relatives. They've died a miserable death. We've destroyed all these small businesses. People have lost their jobs. And all they did was just delay this from happening by 6 months. We're now back in exactly the same position. Surely this shows that the lockdown was not the correct action to take. You've pointed out enough times, Max. I've pointed out what they should have done is just kept the old people safe, basically. Kept the people that were at risk, the old people, the people with comorbidities. They should have been kept in their homes, basically. And they should have had food that was brought out to them, and everybody else, the people that weren't at risk, they would have been okay to go about their daily lives. The average age of death of COVID-19 is 82, and the average age when people die anyway is 81. And it's just incredible that this is still going on, and Boris Johnson is now talking about locking down all of the North, and we're just in exactly the same situation. It's just incredible. And it's the Daily Mail that are reporting this. This isn't alternative news sites that are saying this, and I just don't understand why they are not admitting that actually what they have done was the wrong move. That what they're doing is saying, no, we're going to have more of it. It's like with diversity, isn't it? We see all these problems that diversity bring, and instead of doing something about the problems, they say, well, the answer to it is more diversity. If we've got white people that aren't engaging with their communities, they're not engaging with the political system, and they live in 99% white areas, what we need to do is we need to fill them up full of diversity as well. Absolutely ludicrous. It's the reason why we've got all this diversity is why people aren't engaging with the system. They feel they've got nobody representing them. But I've gone a little bit off topic here, Max. But yeah, what are your thoughts on the total failure of the lockdown and the fact they refuse to admit that they have failed?
Well, I think I said a few weeks back that one of the reasons why the government can't admit that they were wrong is because they will be deluged in all sorts of claims for compensation from people who have had their businesses ruined. You know, so many small business people have been ruined as a result of lockdown, particularly people that work in the hospitality and entertainment sector, and if the government admit that the lockdown hasn't worked and it was counterproductive and it shouldn't have been And if the conclusion that's drawn is that it shouldn't have been introduced in the first place, then I'm sure all these people will start to sue the government for compensation. And as you can imagine, the amount of compensation government would have to pay would be enormous. But and also the other casualty of doing that would be the reputations of the government ministers who supported the lockdown and who used the Operation Fear in order to scare everybody into obeying the rules. All those people will again also be held responsible. It's interesting that there was an article I read within the last couple of days or so, and where the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, publicized the fact that he had been and that Belarus had been offered, I think it was over $1 billion for them to, if they would introduce a lockdown and require their citizens to wear face masks, etc. Now, I don't know whether that was he described it as a bribe, or certainly it was described as a bribe in the article. Whether or not it was actually a bribe or not is perhaps a different matter, but that's the way it was described in the article. And it's not clear whether the money was offered to Lukashenko personally, or whether it was offered to Belarus as a nation. But either way, what it shows is that the World Health Organization and the International Monetary Fund do seem to be pressurizing countries into taking the kind of action that our own government here in the UK took.
Yeah, the IMF, the World Bank, they were doing the same with India. I think they offered them a huge loan if they would institute this lockdown. I mean, there's all sorts of theories that we could get into as to why it is. Is it because of the vaccines? Do they want to vaccinate everybody? And when they vaccinate everybody, will there be a tiny little nano chip in there with the vaccine that will label everybody so that they will be able to keep records of everyone? Is it that they want to centralize all the businesses and just have the huge mega corporations that are left? They want to wipe out the middle class. Is that the reason for doing this? Is it just that the power has gone to their heads? I mean, you could say with Boris Johnson, well, he's been a victim of this, and he was particularly bad for him. He was in hospital for a few days, and he seems to have lost his mojo ever since. He seems to have lost that joie de vivre, as they call it. And I think he's particularly scared of it. But now that we've seen Donald Trump take it on and defeat it in a matter of days, and he's back there on the campaign trail now, I would hope that Boris Johnson would realise that he was just particularly unlucky. I mean, on the other side of this, you can say, well, they've got this long COVID. There are people that are really suffering after this, and it is a novel virus. We don't know what the after effects of this are going to be. But the clearest thing of all is that we did the wrong thing by this lockdown. Belarus haven't had a lockdown. They haven't had a huge explosion in cases. Sweden didn't have a lockdown. They haven't had as many problems with it as we have in Britain. And now we're right back to square one. And we were told that the only reason we were having it is because we wanted to flatten the curve with the hospitals. There's no talk of that now. It's, oh, we need to keep doing this until it's gone completely. And that's just not going to happen. We are going to have to learn to live with it and just be careful if you don't want to catch it. I think that's all we can say. I did bring something up last week, actually, that they had they'd done a study and they showed that you can't catch it from surfaces. So all the hand cleansing and all the rest of it, that it's not very likely you're going to catch it from any surfaces. It is caught from breathing. And in which case, then a mask probably will help. But to shut down all these businesses and prevent people from taking their own responsibility for what happens, that's the shocking thing. I mean, we were always known for bringing democracy to the world and responsibility and education and making decisions for ourselves and the freedoms that we had in Britain. And yet we just seem very, very, very keen to just give them all up and hand them all over to the government. But yes, it's shocking. A side effect from it as well has been the fact that all these masks and gloves are now turning up on the beach. Apparently they take 450 years for these masks to degrade. Yes. They've forgotten all about climate change. Now they've got another reason to interfere in everybody's lives and have this huge authority over us, they seem to have forgotten about that, because that was the point of that, wasn't it? We could have a world government and everybody would have to agree to these things. And now they've got the virus, and they can say, well, we have to have a world government and everybody agreeing to things to fight against the virus. It's the same goal. It's the same end goal, isn't it? It's always the same end goal.
It's finding a reason to insist that we have to have world government. That's what international politics seems to be obsessed by in recent years. They frantically search for a reason why a national government can't solve the biggest and the most threatening problem that threatens mankind. And so they find these problems that threaten mankind and they then insist that we have to have world government in order to prevent disaster.
Yeah, what is it? Order out of chaos. The old Masonic saying, order ab chao. And they are encouraging the chaos at the moment, and they're providing the solution to it. They're providing that they will get rid of this if we just all obey their authority and censor everything on the internet that questions their authority or provides alternative studies on the cause of this. It's all I just can't believe that they won't actually admit that they've done wrong. I mean, only 12 MPs actually stood up and refused to okay the new coronavirus legislation, which was looked at, because they have to look at it over every 6 months, and there was talk in the papers that there was going to be a rebellion, but it was just 12 MPs in all that would actually stand against what the government are doing. It's well, we've got other subjects to talk about today. You were mentioning the youngest child that's ever been charged with terrorist offences, Max, to me before we went on air.
Well, there's a story on the I saw it on the Daily Mail website, in which it tells of a 15-year-old boy who comes from Eastleigh in Hampshire, who is the youngest person to be tried for a terrorism offence, and a jury in Leicester dismissed the claims that he had been mesmerised by martyrdom, and he appears to have avoided being convicted of acts in preparation for terrorism. I'll read you what it says here. A 15-year-old schoolboy has been cleared of preparing terrorist acts after being accused of trying to make bombs from his bedroom. The teenager from Eastleigh, Hampshire, was the youngest person to be tried for plotting terrorism and sobbed with relief as a jury dismissed claims that he had been mesmerised by martyrdom. Prosecutors had alleged the boy, then 14, had tried to manufacture rudimentary bombs during lockdown after falling under the influence of ISIS. In homemade videos, he said he would carry out jihad, but jurors believed his defence that he held views of extremist networks as nasty stuff and evil. The teenager said he had used phrases meaning non-believers after hearing the word in the film The Four Lions. In his evidence, the boy also denied having any plans to kill himself or anybody else. While he was in the witness box, his defence barrister, Mary Pryor QC, had asked, "How do you feel about it now?" The boy replied, "Upset, because it is nasty stuff. I don't like watching it because it's evil. I don't mean what I said." Referring to words said in homemade videos about martyrdom, Miss Pryor asked him, "Did you plan to kill yourself?" He replied, "No." Miss Pryor continued, "Did you plan to kill somebody else?" He replied firmly, "No, I did not." During the two-week trial, the teenager was also asked how he had found out about how to make bombs, to which he replied, "A YouTube video." Questioning the defendant further, his barrister, Mary Pryor QC, said, "How many videos did you look at?" To which the teenager replied, "I can't remember, but it was a few." Ms. Pryor continued, "Did you understand that they make an explosion?" To which the boy replied, "Yes." The court was shown a video the defendant had recorded on one of the bottle bombs exploding in his wardrobe. The jury at Leicester Crown Court rejected the allegations on Friday after deliberating for 9 hours and 10 minutes following a two-week trial. Counter-terrorism policing South East believed the teenager from Eastleigh, Hampshire, was the youngest person to be charged with preparing acts of terrorism on UK soil. And this case just really smacks of a double standard in terms of the way the courts interpret this kind of evidence, because it's a matter of years ago now. It's 4 years ago now, I think, that the organization National Action was prescribed by the Home Secretary at the time, and has been designated there since then by the media as a terrorist organization. And a number of young people who are not that many years older than the young lad in this case were convicted of preparing acts of terrorism and similar charges when the evidence against them was much less than appears here. Some people were convicted of being a member of a terrorist organization because they had simply associated with other people who had been convicted of being a member of a terrorist organization. I think that there is a clear double standard here in terms of the amount of evidence suggesting that this young lad might have been involved in preparing for acts of terrorism, compared with the amounts of evidence that were collected on a number of these National Action people, where the courts took a completely different view.
Well, I mean, this young lad here, this 14-year-old lad, he wasn't just preparing them. He'd actually created bombs in his bedroom. He tested them. He recorded the fact that he was blowing things up in his bedroom while watching ISIS videos. And if you contrast that with some of the alleged members of National Action, some of them were accused of preparing for acts of terrorism because they had the book, The Anarchist's Cookbook, which I think is still available on Amazon. But that was given up as evidence that these people could have been preparing for terrorism because they had this book there. They didn't actually find any bomb-making equipment or anything like that. I mean, that really is a shocking double standard there. You would hope that somebody at the age of 14, where would they be getting these ideas from? And the fact that he was calling unbelievers, obviously he would have been calling them kafirs, wouldn't he? He'd been using the Islamic name for unbelievers.
Infidel, I would think.
Perhaps. Infidel. Where was he getting this stuff from? How can he say that he was following a comedy for, like, I mean, that comedy is about jihadis.
The photographs associated with this article show a box with two improvised bottle bombs in it. But it also shows one of the other photographs also shows a cardboard box with a book which looks suspiciously like the Quran, together with a prayer hat of the sort that Muslims would wear at prayer. And so I think that there is clear evidence here that this boy was to some extent influenced by Islamic extremism.
Definitely. I couldn't believe that he was influenced by a comedy. I mean, why would you then dress up as the bad guys, as the terrorists? It's a comedy about bumbling terrorists. And actually going to the... you could imagine him dressing up in fancy dress, maybe, or dressing up in fancy dress like some of the characters from the film, but not actually making explosives and explosive equipment. I wonder what the jury were like. I mean, where did this trial take place? Did it take place in a heavily diversified area with lots of mosques in it? I mean, that would be the sort of question that I would be asking. Does it say on there which Crown Court it was that this jury was at?
In Leicester.
Leicester, right. Well, Leicester is a place that has lots of Muslims in it. It's one of the places that is locked down at the moment. It's got a very high proportion of Muslims in it. So what we may well be seeing there is nepotism in the jury. The jury may be saying, well, we are Muslims and we are not allowed to convict other Muslims. We're not allowed to tell on other Muslims to non-Muslims, and we can't convict him. I mean, it is against the Islamic law to convict another Muslim in a non-Muslim court. They're not to, what is the word? They're not to be witnesses against other Muslims. That's what it is. They're not allowed to be witnesses against other Muslims. So surely they wouldn't be able to have found, they wouldn't have been able to convict him as guilty anyway because of their religion.
In fairness, it could be that this young lad was actually just simply fantasizing, and that he had learned about sort of infidels through reading the Quran. He had seen some videos where Islamic extremism was presented in a comic format, and he may have just out of curiosity just constructed some bombs just to see if they would work, and it could be that he talked about jihad in videos, again kind of just play acting, or LARPing as the word is, live action role play. He could have just been LARPing in terms of all this, and if that was the case and the court accepted it, then that's fine. But by the same token, where there were young people who were associated with National Action who just simply had a copy of the anarchist cookbook and did nothing else other than that, and who perhaps LARPed to some extent by talking about things that they might do in a kind of fantasy way, then their arguments and their defences of that they were simply LARPing and that it was simply a kind of youthful fantasy should have been accepted as well. And that's why there is the double standard here.
And also, they're saying that this is a 14-year-old that's been doing this. I seem to recall that there have been reports in the press recently about how the far right, the extreme far right, are getting younger and younger, and how it's 14 and 15-year-olds that are the real threat. And yet, what 14, 15-year-olds do we see? Well, we see a Muslim 14-year-old that's actually being tried for this. We don't see young white lads that are being tried for this. There was a report recently that was suggesting this and saying, what can we do about this? Well, what we can do about the threat of young white people going down the wrong path is the government should be supporting groups like Patriotic Alternative that promote community building and preserve our heritage and preserve our culture, and get these young people that are at risk of being radicalized and being extremized, and turn that into something positive. Get them involved in a pro-white group that wants to do pro-white things for the community, that will take them hiking and camping and paintballing and learning about their culture, learning about their heritage. Turn that into something positive and get these young people involved in society. Get them to feel that they have a stake in society. The way you do that is by helping out these nationalist groups who are dedicated to looking out for their people. But instead, as I pointed out earlier, they think, well, the way to deal with this is more diversity. And we'll try and silence these groups that are speaking out and advocating for white people. And that's why you end up with whites doing it, these young whites doing it. Sorry, go on, Max.
Whilst on the one hand, the authorities accept that there are Islamic extremists who are the bad guys, and that there are Islamists who are moderates, who are the good guys, when it comes to nationalist politics and right-wing politics, there are only bad right-wing people and bad nationalists as far as the authorities are concerned. And so, again, that demonstrates a double standard in terms of the way in which the authorities approach this. And just as the authorities would feel that it was perfectly appropriate to introduce boys that have been to some extent seduced by the a sort of romanticized notion of jihad and introduce them to what they believe to be moderate Muslim leaders, so, as you just said, the police and the authorities ought to introduce young nationalists who perhaps have been seduced by more extreme nationalist groups to the more moderate nationalist groups, as you just said. And Patriotic Alternative, I would imagine, would be an ideal organisation to take on that role.
Well, it's the community building side of it. I mean, these youngsters, they feel that they've got no hope. They feel that they've got nobody that's speaking out for them. They've got no job prospects. Any time that they actually speak about how they feel, they get accused of being racist. And then you've got other people that encourage this. You've got people that encourage this in these hidden chat rooms, and they say, well, yes, there is no hope and we need to have a revolution. And they will encourage them to be violent, and they'll encourage them to do stupid things. And that's the path to radicalism. But there is another path towards doing what you can for your community and being the best person that you can be. And that's what we will try and promote here at Radio Albion and try and reach out to these youngsters. Because when you're young, you don't realise the consequences of your actions. And you see all these terrible things happening and you think, well, I really want to do something. And, you know, we could challenge that and do so many positive things, charities for white homeless, going litter picking, just going out on organisations with older nationalists and learning from them and learning about our history and about our past and teaching them about the things that they're going to be good at doing, the things that British people have always been good at doing and will still be good at doing them. And they just don't teach children at school about this anymore. All these sort of things are ways that you can prevent people from being radicalized, but all the while that they just lump us all in one bracket and say, well, it's all bad, they're all extremists, you're just going to keep having this problem and it's not going to get any better. And we are the ones that are really trying to do something about this. They claim to be doing something about it. They say, well, we've had all these studies. The most recent one was the Tony Blair study, and they did a study of hundreds of young people, and they said that 20% of young people are now radicalized. 20% of young white people are extremists, and they're showing extremist views. And they listed these views, and they're not extremists. They're views that most people have. We are being replaced in our own homelands. You only have to look at places like London, 60% non-white, to see that the truth in that. Islam is incompatible with the West. I mean, we've had crusades against Islam. Islam has tried to take over Europe. So quite clearly, it isn't compatible. We don't have a one world religion. We have these different religions because they are different ways of doing things. They have different standards. And the final bit that they said was extremist was saying that democracy is broken and it has to be replaced. And I would say, well, I don't think it has to be replaced. I think it needs to be improved upon. Democracy certainly has a place, but when you're going to take a poll of people, they need to be qualified to give an answer. It's no good taking a poll of people that don't know what they're talking about to find out what the course of action should be. You want to be taking a poll of people that are eminently qualified in whatever the subject is. So democracy needs to be worked on. But saying democracy is broken, apparently that's extremist now. And that was a mainstream theme in the Daily Mail and the Daily Express and the supporters of Brexit, that democracy was broken. We had all these MPs in Parliament that didn't want Brexit and they were going directly against what the majority of the country had voted for. So these things that they were saying are extremist, they're right of centre, but they're not completely out of the mainstream, completely off the reservation, which is what the definition of extremism is. And their main worry was that these kids feel they don't have a stake in society. And how are you going to give them that stake in society if they don't have representation, if they don't have white people speaking up specifically for them? When you've got somebody that's speaking up for all children, and certainly the blacks and the non-whites, well, the white kids are saying, well, he's not speaking for me, is he? Where are the scholarships for the white students? Why have the black students got scholarships to Cambridge and scholarships and grants to Oxford and the white kids don't? You know, until they actually properly address this, it's just going to get worse. And they claim they're trying to address it. We're trying to address it as well. And I think we're the only ones that are actually showing results with it, because their studies just show that things are getting worse. And yet groups like Patriotic Alternative are reaching out to more and more people. More and more people are joining up. There's young people that want to get involved. They want to start doing positive things with their lives rather than you know, sitting around talking about silly things in chat rooms and fantasizing about things that if those chat transcripts were to be found by the police, that, you know, they could get charged with terrorism, all just for silly fantasizing on the internet. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, before we get into our Greatest Britons.
No, I think you thoroughly covered that, actually. That's a very comprehensive review of that situation that is a bit of a blight on our society at the moment.
Yeah, I think about it a lot. You know, I really do think about it a lot. And I would hope that we are a positive force in that, and that we are making some headway in reaching out to these vulnerable youths. Well, our Greatest Briton this week is Colin Campbell, the first Baron of Clyde, which was suggested by you, Max. Do you want to, had you heard of him before? Was this somebody that you'd read about before? Is that why you suggested him?
Yes, he is somebody that I've read a certain amount about before, and he just seemed like a the sort of person who would be the type of leader that most people would want to have in terms of his courage and determination, and the sort of person who one encounters in positions of authority nowadays less and less.
There's a good story arc as well. I mean, he starts from really humble beginnings, and then through a combination of buying promotions and being promoted for his bravery and his courage, I mean, he manages to make it right up to the top, and he's in charge of the entire military of India. We've talked about this before, about how you could buy yourself a promotion and how this was a good thing. So this story in itself is a good example of how somebody from humble beginnings in the British Empire, they could work themselves right the way up. And that was something that the British were very proud of, was that we had this maneuverability. You could maneuver yourself from the lower classes up to the higher classes with the British Empire, basically, and going out to these far-flung parts of the empire and showing people what you were made of. Well, Field Marshal Colin Campbell, first Baron of Clyde, GCB KCSI, was born on the 20th of October 1792, and he died on the 14th of August 1863, and he was a British Army officer. After serving in the Peninsular War and the War of 1812, he commanded the 98th Regiment of Foot during the First Opium War, and then commanded a brigade during the Second Anglo-Sikh War. He went on to command the Highland Brigade at the Battle of Alma, and with his thin red line of Highlanders, which is where we get the term from, he repulsed the Russian attack on Balaclava during the Crimean War. At an early stage of the Indian Mutiny, he became Commander-in-Chief of India, and in that role he relieved and then evacuated Lucknow, and after attacking and decisively defeating Tatya Tope, who was the head of the Indian rebels, at the Second Battle of Kawanpur, captured Lucknow again. While still Commander-in-Chief, he dealt with the White Mutiny amongst East India Company troops and organised the army sent east in the Second Opium War. And don't worry, because if this is going too fast, because we will look at selected parts of this in detail. And the historian Adrian Greenwood argued in a 2015 biography of Campbell that he was a much more effective and significant commander than previously thought. I mean, that's an incredible lot of different places that he's actually been to and taken part in battles. I mean, you got China there, you've got India, you've got the Crimea, you've got Russia, you've got Spain, you've got these peninsular wars. I mean, just incredible to think that just in one lifetime that went on. And that could have been anybody in the British Empire that wanted to do this and took the time just to join the army or to join the navy. And you could really have adventures back there in that time. Do you want to comment on this introduction, Max?
Well, just to say that in the biographies that we have discussed of other significant Britons, this is a period in our history when the European nations were expanding and colonizing other parts of the world, and that expansion and colonization presented lots of opportunities for people who were perhaps lowly born to make their fortune, to gain a prestigious reputation for helping to expand the British Empire. And so it was. It provided a playground, perhaps is a way that you could describe it, for people who were ambitious and who were courageous and who were forward-thinking and goal-oriented.
We had a lot of skirmishes with these other European nations as well. We've got the Peninsular Wars here with Napoleon. We've got wars with Russia. And at least we don't tend to have much of that going on today. That is something that we can be proud of, I think, today, is that we're not still fighting amongst our European nations like we were back then. Well, he began from humble beginnings. Campbell was born Colin MacLiver, the eldest of the four children of John MacLiver, a cabinet maker in Glasgow, and Agnes MacLiver, née Campbell. His mother and one of his twin sisters died while he was still a boy. His only brother was killed fighting in the Peninsular War. Having been educated at the High School of Glasgow, his uncle, Major John Campbell, took over his care and sent him to the Royal Military and Naval Academy at Gosport. So he hasn't had a good start in life. His mother died when he was still a boy, and his only brother dies as well. So he's the only boy that's left. His father is not that well off. He's a cabinet maker. He's a carpenter. And his uncle takes over his care eventually and just sends him off to the Royal Military Academy. And all he's had up until that point is just he's just been educated at the High School of Glasgow, not any of these private schools or anything like that. I mean, he's starting right at the bottom of the pile here, I think, Max, don't you?
Yeah, and I think it was a tradition going back into medieval times of fathers, instead of raising their sons themselves, they would pass their sons on to their brothers, who were obviously the sons' uncles, and it was the job of the uncles to raise the sons. And this was done in recognition of the fact that fathers sometimes were a little bit too soft on their sons, and that it was felt that that an uncle would be less soft on the son and would make a man of him much more quickly. And that seems to be the case here with Colin Campbell.
Yeah, I'm quite close to my uncles, still quite close to my uncles today, but they certainly took an interest in my childhood and my education. Well, we'll start by looking at the Peninsular War. The Peninsular War, 1807 to 1814, is the military conflict fought by Spain and Portugal, assisted by Great Britain, against the invading and occupying forces of the First French Empire for control of the Iberian Peninsula during the Napoleonic Wars. Campbell was posted to Gibraltar in 1810 and fought at the Battle of Barossa in March 1811, taking command of the 9th Foot's flank companies as the senior officer, not the hors de combat. His bravery was noted by General Sir Thomas Graham. Serving in his battalion's light company, he fought at the Battle of Vittoria in June 1813 and at the Siege of San Sebastian, where Allied forces under the command of Arthur Wellesley, Marquess of Wellington, who we have already covered, they captured the city of San Sebastian in northern Basque country from its French garrison under Louis Emmanuel Rey. The attack resulted in the ransacking and devastation of the town by fire. Here, in the first assault on the 25th of July 1813, Campbell led the Forlorn Hope and was wounded twice while leading a storming party. So he's already a senior officer by this time, and I should imagine he probably purchased that. Do you know any of the details on that, whether it was purchased or given to him, Max?
I don't know the details of that, no, but he certainly earned himself a promotion as a result of leading the Forlorn Hope at San Sebastian. The term Forlorn Hope is often used inappropriately, and the term Forlorn Hope is actually a mistranslation of the Dutch Verloren Hoop. And Verloren Hoop, the German word Verloren means lost, and Hoop meant troop. And the Germans have got a word for it as well, which I think is Verloren Haufen, which means, again, lost troop. And there's another term that the French have for this same thing. And basically, very often in a battle, there will be a requirement for one detachment of troops to effectively make a suicide charge into the face of enemy gunfire. And the suicide groups were the Forlorn Hope. They were the people who were likely to suffer something like 90% casualties during the course of the battle, and perhaps none of the Forlorn Hope would survive at all. And so often what happened, I know as far as the German army was concerned, they used to pay people who were in the Forlorn Hope, they used to pay them double the wages that were paid to ordinary soldiers. Often the soldiers that volunteered for the Forlorn Hope would be offered large cash bonuses for taking part if they survived. And very often there were occasions where every soldier that took part in the Forlorn Hope would be promised a commission or a promotion as a result of their participation in the Forlorn Hope. And so the fact that that Colin Campbell led the Forlorn Hope at San Sebastian, which was a heavily fortified town. The fact that he led the Forlorn Hope shows a tremendous amount of courage on his part. And that almost certainly would have been would have catapulted his career to a higher level as a result.
So it'd be taking a bit of a gamble, really. If you really wanted to get somebody, you could take this gamble that you might be in the 10% that survived. But if you did survive, you'd have a good reward. Maybe you'd get a commission. Maybe you'd get a promotion. You'd certainly get a leg up. So I guess this was a way for very poor people to take this chance and to really make something of themselves. Well, San Sebastian stands on a peninsula extending into the Bay of Biscay and runs generally north to south. The southern face of the city's fortifications was very strong, with a large hornwork blocking the approaches, with the higher town walls mounting guns that could fire over the hornwork to protect it. "It was the strongest fortification I ever saw, Gibraltar excepted," wrote William Dent. On its eastern side, the city was protected by the estuary of the Urimia River, and British engineers detected a weak point near the riverfront at the city's southeastern corner, where assaults were possible across the riverbed, but only at low tide from both the south and the east. Breaching batteries could be placed south of the city and in sandhills on the east side of the estuary, which could themselves be protected from counterattack by the river. British sea power could not be utilised because the Biscayan blockading fleet was under strength, and French vessels regularly brought in supplies and reinforcements while taking out the wounded and sick soldiers. Because of this, Wellington could not expect to starve out the city. He would have to breach the walls and carry the city by assault. And bear in mind, this is a really strong fortification, he says here. It's only second only to the Rock of Gibraltar. So this is a real suicide mission that they are on, trying to take this town. First, they captured a convent before the batteries were constructed to fire on the city, and then at dawn on the 25th of July, an attack was launched. It was intended that after the explosion of a mine, the troops would assault the Hornwork mine breach and the two town wall breaches, but the mine was exploded too early when it was still dark, and the troops attacked, but they could not get support from the artillery as it was too dark for them to see. The Hornwork was assaulted, but the follow-up troops were late arriving and the advance party were beaten back. The troops assaulting the walls were exposed to fire for 300 yards across the tidal flats, and although they reached the top of the breaches, the supports were again too slow and they were beaten back with a great loss of life. The British actually suffered 693 killed and wounded and 316 captured, including Harry Jones and Colin Campbell, who were both wounded while leading the Forlorn Hope. And I found this interesting because Wikipedia says, oh, Harry Jones led the Forlorn Hope. And then you've got all these pictures that say Colin Campbell led the Forlorn Hope. And there are other reports of this that say that Colin Campbell led it. And I couldn't work out what happened here, whether one of them was leading it and he got wounded and the other one took over, or what happened. Do you know anything about this? Is Harry Jones as well as Colin Campbell attributed with it?
I don't know the sort of detail that you're looking for there. I would assume that if both of them have claimed that they led the Forlorn Hope, that there would have been successive waves of Forlorn Hope. And if Colin Campbell had led, say, the initial wave and then had been injured, and that wave of troops had the attack that was starting to peter out, it could well be that a second wave of Forlorn Hope would have been sent in to try and retrieve the situation.
That explains it. I couldn't find more details, but there is a very famous painting of Colin Campbell leading the charge here. And I think this was really the first time that he came to the public's attention, because he really did make huge waves among the public throughout his life for his bravery and his courage. As I say, he was wounded here in this one. Eventually, his regiment returned to England many years later, and in 1828, he was posted to Ireland. From late 1830, they were called upon to police the Irish Tithe War, and Campbell purchased an unattached lieutenant colonelcy on the 26th of October 1832, becoming the commanding officer of the 9th Regiment of Foot on the 8th of May 1835. But he then exchanged it to become the commanding officer of the 98th Regiment of Foot on 19th of June 1835. So we see here that he's purchasing these titles for himself and starting to work his way up. He then commanded that regiment at the Battle of Ching Kiang in July 1842 during the First Opium War. Promoted to colonel on the 23rd of December 1842, he became commandant of Hong Kong by the end of that year. He was appointed an aide-de-camp to the Queen on the 23rd of December 1842 and a companion of the Order of the Bath on the 24th of December 1842. Both of those wouldn't have been bought, they would have been given to him for bravery. After fighting many battles in China and India in early 1854, shortly after the Crimean War broke out, Campbell accepted the command of the Highland Brigade. He was promoted to Brevet Brigadier General on the 21st of February 1854 and to Major General on the 20th of June 1854. The Highland Brigade distinguished itself at the Battle of Alma in September 1854, and with his thin red line of Highlanders, Campbell repulsed the Russian attack on Balaclava in October 1854. And before we get into the thin red line, it's interesting here that he's been out in China and he's actually been made the commandant of Hong Kong as well. So this shows you just how spread out we were. I mean, in the last episode we did, we talked about how we had connections in the Mediterranean, and even in Roman times we were all connected out across Europe. Well, now Britain is right over the other side of the world. He's traveling over to Hong Kong. He's back over here in the Crimean. Next minute he's in Ireland. And literally all over the world we were able to travel. And this is before the time of airplanes, obviously. Be traveling by sail, basically, for a lot of it, I should imagine. I don't think they even had steam engines at this time. It fascinates me that just under the power of the wind and under horseback, we were still able to conquer the world and travel from one part to another and communicate and transfer letters and know what was going on over the other side of the world. It's just amazing that we were able to achieve all of that. Do you want to comment on any of these positions?
An amazing feat of administration, I was just going to say, in terms of that sort of level of communication that you were talking about and the transferring backwards and forwards. Yeah, I think that it's significant that Colin Campbell became the commanding officer of the Highland Brigade, in that the Highland soldiers, as well as like Northern Irish soldiers as well, the Irish brigades that have been formed, were often regarded as elite groups, because the Irish and the Scots were regarded as being people of a martial race, basically. That's the way that they very often were conceived of. And the same goes really for the regiments that were recruited from places like Coldstream, where the Coldstream Guards came from, in more recent times, organisations like the Parachute Regiment and the SAS and the Royal Marines, etc. But it would have been Colin Campbell's prowess in leading troops in battle, because I think one of the things that he was renowned for was actually leading. You know, when he was leading the Forlorn Hope, he would have been leading the Forlorn Hope. He would have been one of the, up front, charging, and, you know, with his saber in his hand, and he would have been involved in the fighting, unlike the situation that we often see in more modern times, where commanding officers sit back from the actual battlefront themselves and direct the other troops. In those days, the commanding officers would have led their troops into battle, and so, you know, he was somebody of exceptional courage.
Just to pick up on what you were saying there about the administration, again, that's something that the British are well known for, is being great administrators. And if you think how much administration was required for a worldwide empire and the communications that were needed when you've just got horseback and sail, it's an incredible achievement, actually, that we were able to manage this great empire.
Well, I think there would have been some steam engines by then. I don't think it would necessarily all been by that. And certainly there would have been locomotives. So one of the reasons why we laid railway tracks across Africa and across India were in order to speed up transport as well.
Yeah, this is 1854, and I can't recall when we first started using steam locomotives. Back in Roman times, you were saying. the other day, Max, in that last episode we did. It was first invented.
Well, that's right. It was back, I think it might have even been pre-Roman times, so where the Greek inventor, Hero, invented a little steam engine, which was just like a little sort of spinning propeller thing driven by steam, that he created as a toy to amuse children. But he didn't think it didn't occur to him that he could use that same kind of propulsion to drive a locomotive. And you know, had he done that, then the Roman Empire would perhaps have eventually become as large as the British Empire was.
Well, it must have been around about this time that we had it. Anyway, I'm embarrassed that I don't know when we first came across steam. I'm going to have to look that up after we've finished recording this. Well, as I said, this thin red line, this is where the term the thin red line comes from. In this incident, around 500 men of the 93rd Sutherland Highlanders, aided by a small force of 100 walking wounded, 40 detached guardsmen, and supported by a substantial force of Turkish infantrymen, and Wikipedia makes a big point of that, a substantial force of Turkish infantrymen led by Sir Colin Campbell, and that's all it has on the actual Wikipedia page. But if you do a little bit more digging, you find out what happened, and we'll find out what happened to these Turkish infantrymen. They fired at the Russian cavalry. Previously, Campbell's Highland Brigade had taken part in actions at the Battle of Alma and at the Siege of Sevastopol. There were more Victoria Crosses presented to the Highland soldiers at that time than at any other, and the event was lionised in the British press and became an icon of the qualities of the British soldier in a war that was arguably poorly managed and becoming increasingly unpopular. So we actually see here that we've got members of the army that are held up as heroes in the press, and back home in Britain, they're calling for these people, and rather like pop stars of today, I would have thought, these brave soldiers that fought in these battles. Now, Colin Campbell, the first Baron of Clyde, is said to have told his men, "There is no retreat from here, men. You must die where you stand." Sir Colin's aide, John Scott, is said to have replied, "Aye, Sir Colin, if needs be, we'll do that." Campbell formed the 93rd into a line two deep, the thin red line. Convention dictated that the line should be four deep. However, Campbell felt he had insufficiently trained men to form a square and met the charge head on with the two deep firing line. As the Russian cavalry approached, the Turks on their flanks broke and fled. The 93rd discharged two volleys at 800 and 500 yards respectively. However, they did not get a chance to discharge one at point-blank range, as the Russians had turned away. Accounts of the Highlanders state they started forward for a countercharge before the final volley, but Sir Colin stopped them with a cry of, "93rd, damn you, Highlanders, for all that eagerness." The Times correspondent, William H. Russell, wrote that he could see nothing between the charging Russians and the British regiment's base of operations at Balaclava but the thin red streak tipped with a line of steel of the 93rd. This was then popularly condensed into the thin red line, the phrase becoming a symbol of British composure in battle. And it's still used today. Obviously, these were the redcoats at this time. But I do find it funny that the Turks just ran away. As soon as it started, the Turks fled. And yet Wikipedia makes such a big thing about the fact that there was this multicultural troop, that there were Turks there. But when you look into it, they just ran away. And of course, that's why you don't really want to have an army filled up, a multicultural army, because that's going to happen.
But one of the things very often that used to happen in battles in these days, during those times, was that the battles would be set piece kind of battles where large bodies of soldiers would be told to advance towards the enemy, and advancing would ordinarily in those days have meant walking towards the enemy with your bayonet fixed until you were told to charge over the final few yards, and then sort of engage the enemy in hand-to-hand combat. In order to get soldiers so that they would be prepared to do that, obviously there's a great amount of discipline has to be instilled during their training, but also at the start of battles, it was customary very often for the soldiers to be given a dose of gunfire, which was usually a half a tumbler of rum or something of that sort, so that they were well liquored up before the battle, and so that they would fight very, very ferociously. And I would imagine that that kind of thing would have been seen at the Battle of Sevastopol.
Well, that's pretty brave there anyway, like just two lines instead of four lines and taking the Russians on like that. The Russians came up with an excuse.
Sorry to interrupt you. The Turkish troops, of course, would have been Muslims, and so they wouldn't have had their gunfire, and so that may have been the difference between the performance of the two sets of troops.
Good point. Alcohol is haram. I think the Russians said that they were just on a reconnaissance, and they'd got all they needed. They had seen what they needed to see, so they turned tail and fled. But of course, the British story is that we scared them off with our thin red line. Well, Campbell was then promoted to the local rank of Lieutenant General on the 23rd of January, 1855, and advanced to Knight Grand Cross of the Order of the Bath on 5th of July, 1855. So he's a knight now, Knight of the Realm. When the Duke of Cambridge returned to England, Campbell took command of the 1st Division Guards and Highland Brigades and commanded the division at the Battle of the Great Redan in September 1855. Promoted to the local rank of Full General on the 28th of December 1855 and the substantive rank of Lieutenant General on the 4th of June 1856, he remained in the Crimea, hoping to take over the overall command. But when General Sir William Codrington was appointed instead, he returned home in a huff. So, I mean, he's got to be pretty popular to be able to think, well, I can just go home if they're not going to give me that role that I want to have. But it does show you how important he'd managed to make himself by this time, and that he did think that he was going to take over the whole of the Crimea. And in actual fact, he was so important by now that royalty is actually asking for him by name. Prince Albert suggested the army in the Crimea be split into two corpsed army and Campbell be given one. Lord Panmure requested that Queen Victoria herself ask Campbell to return and command one of these corps, and Campbell agreed. However, by the time he had returned, the war was virtually over. He commanded the South Eastern District from July to September 1856, and for his services in the Crimean War, he was awarded the Grand Cross of the Sardinian Order of Saints Maurice and Lazarus on the 11th of August 1856, and the Turkish Order of the Mejidi, First Class, on 2nd of March, 1858. The Board of Directors of the East India Company also granted Campbell an annuity of £2,000 per annum for life on the 9th of June, 1858. So we see the link here with the corporations as well, and the East India Company, rather incestuous, these corporations, and also the royalty, the British government and the state. It was almost a part of it. A lot of these battles were on their behalf, really, because they wouldn't accept trade.
How much was that annuity again?
£2,000 per annum.
£3,000?
£2,000.
Oh, £2,000, okay. Which doesn't sound a lot by today's standards, but £2,000 per annum would have been a very substantial amount of money in those days.
A lot of money. I mean, what we're hearing here is he's fighting in the army, and you'd imagine that it would be the country that was rewarding him. The country's rewarding him with all these titles and making him a knight, and then he's got this big trading corporation is paying him lots of money as well. Next, we get into India. On the 11th of July, 1857, at an early stage in the Indian Mutiny, Lord Palmerston offered Campbell the command of all the British forces in India. Promoted to the local rank of Full General in India the same day, he left England the next day and reached Calcutta in August of 1857. He relieved and then evacuated Lucknow in November 1857, and after attacking and decisively defeating Tantia Tope at the Second Battle of Cawnpore in December 1857, he captured Lucknow again in March 1858. So it took him over a month, basically, to get there from England to India. That's how long it obviously took on the boat trip. Do you want to add anything to that, to these bits, Max?
Well, no, just that almost certainly would have been a steam ship that he would have gone round there on. When you think about it, when you get to the late 1800s, early 1900s, that's when the internal combustion engine was being developed, wasn't it, by Benz and Daimler. And so there definitely would have been steam engines long, that there would have been well in use during this period. So So yeah, an extremely sort of well deserved, I would say, judging by, you know, the accomplishments that we've just been talking about, a well deserved promotion for him, and the sort of person that for a country that has an empire, that you would want to have that person running a very substantial part of your empire.
So he was general of the whole of India at this time. Well, let's have a look at this second battle of Kawanpur in 1857. Campbell was withdrawing from Lucknow with 3,000 troops and a convoy containing 2,000 sick, wounded and non-combatants who had been evacuated from Lucknow. But hearing that Kawanpur was in danger, he left his infantry to protect the convoy and moved ahead with his cavalry and horse artillery. To his relief, when he arrived on the northern bank of the Ganges, late on the 27th of November, the bridge was still intact. Windham held the entrenchment, but the Tantia Tope's rebel army had occupied the city of Kawanpur and the ground between the city and the Ganges. Campbell crossed the bridge the next day and deployed his artillery on the northern bank of the river to fire on the rebels threatening the bridge, while slowly filing the carts and other vehicles of the convoy across the bridge. The process took 3 days to complete, although several officers urged Campbell to attack as soon as the north bank was evacuated. Campbell delayed for another 5 days, while all the non-combatants were ferried downriver to safety. Campbell was later to be known for his caution and deliberation in this, becoming irreverently known as Sir Crawling Camel. I'll just stop there because I think that shows he's got the right priorities there, really. He's looking after the people that can't defend themselves, that can't look after themselves. Rather than diving straight in and attacking the enemy, he's protecting the wounded and the non-combatants and everybody else that needed to get away from this. And it shows he's got a sense of humour as well, becoming known as Sir Crawling Camel for this particular bit.
Because had he lost the battle, then the non-combatants and the injured would have just been slaughtered by the enemy.
Yeah, good point. The rebels, meanwhile, had continued to make attacks on the British positions, and with an attack on the 5th of December beaten off, Campbell was now ready to make his own attack, having received 5,600 reinforcements with 35 guns. On the 6th of December, Windham opened a violent bombardment from the entrenchment to deceive the rebels that Campbell was about to attack on their left, but the real attack was made on their right, curling around the city of Kawanpur to threaten the rebels' links to Kalpi. Campbell's artillery, which included many guns that were heavier than those possessed by the rebels, particularly the 24-pounders manned by the sailors of the naval brigade, was the decisive factor. As the Gwalior contingent broke and fled, the Nana Sahib's own retainers and adherents were defeated north of the city. The pursuit by Campbell's cavalry was pressed as hard as possible, capturing almost every gun and cart from the rebels, and at Bithur, the Nana Sahib's treasury was captured the next day, concealed in a well. The rebels had attacked Kawanpur at the most favourable possible moment under one of their most dynamic and charismatic leaders, yet they had been defeated. From this point on, increasing numbers of British reinforcements were to arrive in India, and the rebellion was doomed to defeat, although Tantia Tope and other determined leaders continued to resist for more than a year. And there's all sorts of battles that went on in India with these warlords, these Indian warlords that wanted to take charge of things once the British had civilized an area and brought trade to it. You would get these other warlords, Islamic warlords mainly, that would then try and take over. It's really a hidden part of our history, I think, everything that went on in the British Empire, because today we don't know how to, we try to be embarrassed about it, so we'd rather we didn't look at it. But in actual fact, we've got some really courageous people that took part in this. Do you want to comment on this battle here, Max?
Not specifically on the battle, but on the comment that you just made, which is that this is quite a common thing, that the assumption is that we marched to these countries and these countries were peaceful places that were almost idyllic. And we just charged in and colonized them, and that's not the case. And as was the case in the settlement of North America by Europeans, so was the case in the conquest of India by the Raj, which is that prior to British forces going there, the countries concerned were made up of a myriad number of small principalities and tribes, all of which were arguing and fighting amongst themselves, all of which were trying to capture each other's land and try to capture each other's riches, and all of which would have happily slaughtered the neighbouring tribes had they had the opportunity to do that. And the only difference between our colonisation of India and the intertribal battles that had taken place beforehand was that we were just so much better at conquering foreign countries than the Indian tribes were, and so we were able to conquer the entire subcontinent and quell all opposition, and that's really it. It isn't that our soldiers and that the representatives of the British Empire were more savage or whatever than anybody else. We were just better at fighting, and we defeated them, and so we were just another tribe that was fighting over the land of India. The land of India hadn't been settled and wasn't, you know, we weren't going to a Shangri-La and disrupting a life of an idyllic lifestyle. There we were going to a country where there were which was already plagued by lots and lots of intertribal wars, and we just settled the place and gained control of the entire subcontinent, as I say, and instilled peace, which then enabled India to prosper.
They were totally lawless, weren't they? That was the thing. We brought them law and order and trade and helped them out in many ways, and they were fighting for us. We had lots of Indians that were fighting in our army as well against these other Indian warlords. They knew what side their bread was buttered. They really did. He was finally promoted to the substantive rank of full general on the 14th of May 1858 and raised to the peerage as Baron Clyde of Clydesdale in Scotland on the 3rd of August 1858. In autumn 1858, faced with a further mutiny by the East India Company's European troops who had not received their enlistment bounties, he used British troops to enforce discipline until the British cabinet agreed some concessions. He continued in charge of the operations in India until all aspects of the revolt had died away, and he returned to England in June 1860. In 1854, Campbell was appointed colonel of the 67th Regiment of Foot and subsequently of the 93rd Regiment of Foot. He was promoted to field marshal on 9th of November 1862 and died at Chatham on the 14th of August 1863 and was buried in Westminster Abbey. A statue of Campbell by Carlo Morochetti was erected in Waterloo Place in London in 1867, and a statue of Campbell by John Foley was erected in George Square in Glasgow in 1868. He's made it right to the top there, hasn't he? Buried in Westminster Abbey. I should imagine there was a huge funeral for that many, many people turned out for, and he was finally promoted to field marshal. Isn't field marshal the one over right at the top over everybody, Max? Do you know?
I believe so. Yes.
So he's right in charge of all the troops.
The saddest thing, though, about his death was that he died without ever having married or produced children, and so the genes that produced the brilliance in battle, the genes that produced the courage that he exhibited throughout his career, were not passed on by him to future generations. And so that's should be a cause of sadness for the nation. And it's one of the reasons why soldiers should always father children before they go off to war, so that their genes aren't lost if they get killed in a war. Soldiers should produce children, and therefore, if they equip themselves well and if they've got the kind of genes that produce courageous and effective soldiers, then those genes aren't lost to the nation.
This was a thing, wasn't it? A lot of these adventurers, they knew that it would just be too risky to carry a wife along with them, and the other alternative was to leave the wife at home and never see them. I mean, we've covered a few of these men that didn't actually have wives because their lives were just too risky. And I also read a book that was saying that it was because the British were celibate like this, because they weren't married, that's the reason why they were able to conquer the world, because they weren't as debauched as the continent, because in Spain they had the monkeys and they could see what the monkeys were doing. And of course they copied what the monkeys were doing. And we didn't have monkeys in Britain. So, you know, we didn't, We didn't get involved in these things. We didn't know about these things. And we were celibate, basically. And we still know today for being prudes, aren't we? You know, they sunbathe naked and all the rest of it in Germany. And we're supposed to be prudish in Britain. But that prudishness and that not knowing about these things that went on under the bed sheets, it actually served us really well. And it meant that instead of our energies being concentrated on women, our energies were sublimated and concentrated on going out and conquering the world. And I think he's just another example of that. I'm trying to recall the name of the book. I did a series of narrations on the book, but it just escapes me now. Are the English a Declining Race was the subtitle of the book. Anyway, you can't think what it is either. But anyway, I think, I'm really glad that you brought up Clive Campbell of Clyde there, Max. I think that was a really good idea for us to cover him today. Thank you very much for coming on today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.